Welcome back to Owen's Variety Hour. You know what? Gotta be honest, I've been in a bit of a rush the past 15 minutes. I only got into the station like 5 minutes ago, which was supposed to be like 1 minute before my show started, but whatever. We're just gonna move past it. And that is going to be my excuse for not thinking of something funny to say to start the show. Usually I have some sort of a random list and I pick, but now I have an excuse to have not done that and to have just rushed to this opening. So if that doesn't make for great spontaneous impromptu radio, then I don't know what would. And to bring it all back to me, I've had a pretty good week. Anyone at Laurier will know that it's been St. Patrick's Day, which means that everyone is loud and in the streets. And it's been my fourth St. Patrick's Day here, and my last as an undergrad. I don't know if I'm going to be returning anytime soon as one of those old guys who tries to retain any sort of moments of his fleeting youth, but I think I gave it a good run, and honestly, I'm just getting tired at this point. This year was just exhausting, and I don't know if I can do it again. Looking to the future, next week is actually going to be the final episode of Owen's Variety Hour this week. With the exams coming up, the radio station will be closed, but luckily, since I'll be in the school next semester, I'll still be here. And I'm thinking of some fun, nice little way to send myself off, and I think that's going to be a full episode of Sports Zone next week, which is my much beloved, shortly lived segment where I try to fake my sports knowledge. But I'm gonna have actual notable athletes, some sports writers on, you know, just real experts in the field, people whose voices deserve to be heard, I would say. We might talk about some sports movies, too, even. Notably, the unforgettable classic Major League. Who knows, though? It's not very well planned in advance. But any other things I've done this week is I ended up watching Climax again, the Gaspar Noé movie that I shortly reviewed 2 weeks ago, and it lives up so hard. With some of these more shocking movies, I think I'm always scared that it's just shock value and that's the only appeal to it, but I gotta say that it hits all the same boxes that did the first time, but it is just a completely different experience because I know all these characters right from the start. The first time I watch it, there's so many people that it's pretty overwhelming, but this time we knew their outcomes as well. This made a particular difference in the interview portion at the beginning of the movie when what they're actually saying sticks a lot more because you know how this in turn affects their outcome. An issue I did have, though, is that the theater I saw it at sort of messed up the ending, which people who had seen it would know that it's a pretty big thing, sort of that, like, when the lights turn on, it's just, like, a great experience. But it was on a bit early, and it was just sort of dampened the experience. But my friend who I went with said he didn't really notice, and maybe it's just a negative for people like me who saw it twice. But anyways, it's playing tonight, tomorrow, and Thursday at the Princess, and I think you should all go see it. We're just going to take our first little break here. This is Holly Herndon with Eternal. And for my new discoveries column this week, I'm going to start with talking about that song we just heard, Holly Herndon's Eternal. Holly Herndon is an electronic and glitch pop artist, and this is the second single in support of her upcoming album Proto, which is coming in May, which follows her 2015 album Platform, an album I quite enjoyed, the other single being the song Godmother, released a few months ago, I believe. I hadn't actually heard it until I saw people talking about this new single. But this song, I find it really great. The production is just filled with these interesting sounds, layering them really well with new sounds just popping up. Like, there's this, it's hard to describe, but there's just sounds that's like, wah, that sound really great in the mix and sort of exemplify everything else and support the songwriting, I think. I especially enjoy the use of the human voices in the instrumental, which gives the song a lot of variety compared to other sort of glitchy pop songs. But it's interesting to hear the song along with the other single, Godmother, which is way more of an experimental take for sure. It's hardly even a pop song at all, but rather sort of a collage of vocal sounds and noises, which was, I gotta say, a very surprising first single. Not quite as good as this song, I believe, but it's interesting for sure. But with both of these two songs appearing on the album, I'm very looking forward to seeing how these work together in an album. If there's sort of going to be more like experimental interlude-y songs paired with a bit more straightforward pop songs, or maybe it's just going to be a cool combination of everything, or maybe Godmother's the only experimental odd one out, or the same with Eternal. I'm just really looking forward to how these work together to make an end product, and I'm really looking forward to this album. The next single I want to talk about is the new song from Aviator, entitled Horse. At least I believe it's titled Horse, because it's actually titled H-O-R-S underscore, and I'm going to assume that we're supposed to replace that underscore with an E. But this is just another fun and well-written psych folk song from the Animal Collective member in preparation for his solo album, Cows on Hourglass Pond, which is coming out on Friday, the 22nd. I'm really excited for it. And I'm honestly just only getting more and more convinced that this album's actually going to be great. And I'm just really happy about it because, as I said in my sort of review of an earlier Aviator single, that I've never really been too pleased with his solo output, and especially this year, because I'm not pleased as well with Panda Bear's output. But it's good to hear that Animal Collective solo projects are still going alive and well, relatively. But this song is similar to the previous single, Saturdays. It's just a really, like, fluid and loose folk song with, I'd say, like, the perfect mix of psychedelic sounds that sort of take you away, but not too much to actually lose the song in it. And I'll be playing the song later in the show. But next thing I want to talk about is the new album from Matmos called Plastic Anniversary. And they're an experimental electronic duo who made quite a big name for themselves recently. At least they came onto my map for their very ambitious concepts of their last album, Ultimate Care 2, which is made completely from sounds from their washing machine, which they recorded expertly and then created into this really dynamic sounding set of glitchy techno tracks. It's a really great and entertaining album. It's fun to listen to it, forgetting that it's a washing machine, and then being like, everything you heard is just a sound from a washing machine. And it's pretty funny. But the new album, Plastic Anniversary, is an ode to the duo's 25th anniversary as a couple, so obviously you know it's going to be pretty cute. But the album is constructed of sounds from plastic objects. It's 100% plastic sounds, which is, I'd have to say, a little bit less limiting than the washing machine album was. But right now, I can't tell which one I quite like more, but because this one's also great. But it's just a very odd and abstract album, but I honestly find it quite listenable. Like, it's abstract, but it's also fun and playful at the same time. And I think this would honestly work as a great album to get people more into sort of ambitious electronic music. And now we're going to take another break, and I'm going to play a song from that Matmos album. This is The Crying Pill. So that was Matmos with The Crying Pill. And just to sort of put that theme of that, the fact that every sound on this album is made with plastic, that song is mainly made with a plastic container, an exercise ball, and an amplified DNA kit, as well as a squishy synthetic human tissue that was made as a substitute for corpses in medical schools. So yeah, when Matmos says that they're making an album just out of plastic, it's not the plastic that we all know. It's not any household stuff, per se. Well, for my review this week, I was going to talk about Abbas Kiarostami, the Iranian filmmaker's Kokar trilogy. Now, Kokar is a northern Iranian region, and sort of the concept of what joins a trilogy around this region is that it suffered a massive earthquake in the year 1990, which took over 30,000 lives. Now, the three movies in this trilogy are Where Is My Friend's House? From 1987, Life and Nothing More from 1992, and Through the Olive Trees from 1994. I just need to find that in my notes. But which is interesting to consider the earthquake alongside this, because it took place after the first film, but then before the other two. So that's something interesting about the trilogy and how it relates to this earthquake. But I'm just going to dive into the movies one by one and then talk about the three together. So the first movie is Where Is My Friend's House, or Home. I've seen different translations of it, but I don't think it's that relevant. I feel like Where Is My Friend's House just flows off my tongue better. But this is just a very humanist and friendly story about childhood and friendship. And humanist might end up being a phrase I use many times in this segment, so get used to it. But it is the story of a boy trying to return his friend's homework book so he won't get in trouble with the teacher. The movie starts with them in class, and the teacher threatens to suspend or expel the child if he forgets his homework book another time and does his homework on just any paper, because he needs to teach them discipline as their teacher. And that is done by making them bring their homework book specifically. It doesn't matter if they're doing their homework or not, as long as they have the book. But from there, it's pretty straightforward. It's just a straightforward narrative movie. It keeps going around as the boy keeps looking, and he avoids the conflicts that go on around him, which are mainly adults wanting things from him. His mom wants him to do his own homework before he returns his friends. He wants him to grab some bread for the family. And they aren't really understanding the urgency that he feels about the situation, about how he feels partially responsible that he accidentally took his friend's notebook. And he really fails to explain how there are actual consequences involved with this. But realistically, as we keep going through the movie, we realize that the main conflict throughout this whole journey is himself, as is his youth and immaturity relating to the world around him. It's really funny to watch him go around to different random people in the street, asking if they know where this little boy lives. They don't even talk about his family or anything. It's just the childhood instinct that the world is really that small, that everyone knows the exact same people you do. And to walk into a village and just ask, oh, where's this guy? He's just going to get him within like 10 minutes, because he promised his mom he'd be back in like half an hour. But the whole movie, he's just walking around. But that is really the point that really stuck with me about this movie. And I think it's done really well. Kiarostami just nails this childhood attribute. And it's not really one that you see that often. You obviously see immaturity throughout. But I don't know. You don't see it purely just ran over and over to its like likely ends. But the ending ends up being really sweet too. And it's just a super really genuine, heartwarming, but it's a really small movie. It ends with, spoiler alert, he finds his friend's house, but he realizes it's almost nighttime. And then we just see him turn around and he walks back home. And it doesn't really tell you what he's going to do. But then when they get to the class tomorrow, he hands the friend his book and he's done his homework for him. It's really nice. It's just puts a smile on your face. And something else I noticed when I was thinking about this movie is that I think it's the only Kiarostami movie that I've seen without any cars in it. Because Kiarostami is mainly known for his driving scenes, as fans would know. The next movie in the trilogy is Life and Nothing More, which most of the movie, to exemplify that point I just said, is just some guy driving around with his son. All we know is that they're going to Coker, and where the earthquake has just struck. So it's sort of in the aftermath of everything. There's traffic everywhere. They quite haven't figured out how to operate around this land through the wreckage of everything. And it's not really shown until a bit into the movie, but the main character that's driving around is actually playing the role of the director from Where Is My Friend's House? This isn't exposed until pretty late in the movie when he finally gets to cities surrounding Coker and he's asking for the actors involved. He's driving into Coker so he can check in on the actors that he made the movie with years earlier just to see if they're okay, if anything happened to their family. But this isn't Kiarostami on the screen. This is an actor playing some sort of fictionalized version of him. And along their journey, we sort of see the impact that this natural disaster has had on people. They drive through traffic, past groups of stranded people, the director often asking how to get to Coker, how to get around all the traffic. And as he talks to people, they tell them about their family who was lost in the earthquake and their situations that arose because of this event. And there are also some pit stops in some towns where the director and his son walking around and keep talking to people. And eventually they run into one of the actors from Where's My Friend's House. But something else I noticed was that this sort of goes with some of the themes from that movie, mainly with the childish innocence of the director's son, as he doesn't really seem to fully understand what has happened and how it might affect people. But this takes a great turn when they do run into that character from the movie, albeit a side character, not one of the main ones that the director was looking for. But as the director sort of wants to talk about what happened to them, the kid asks him about the soccer game that was playing on the day of the earthquake and the one that was tonight. And the actor, as much as he seems sort of heartbroken by what happened, he just sort of wants to talk about soccer with the kid. And that was really just like a genuine moment where the kids seem happy and almost excited amidst their terrible situation. But besides this message, there's the topic that needs to be analyzed in this movie of how it actually works. Because as I said, the main character is the director of Where Is My Friend's House, which isn't a fictional movie. It actually was made by Kiarostami. So is this director therefore Kiarostami? Or does he just not want to be the subject of his movie? Or is it just a fictionalized accounting? Throughout the film, this quasi-Kiarostami discusses opinions of art and life with one of the older actors from the movie that they come across. And it's hard to tell if these are supposed to actually reflect some of Abbas's philosophies as a filmmaker. But one of the biggest takeaways I have with this film is how it sort of adds to the humanity angle of his filmmaking. Because as much as this is a fiction story, we are seeing these characters' interactions with people. We are still seeing people's stories. These are real people, presumably, who are involved in the earthquake, who actually suffered loss. And these stories go to reflect those in Coker, in the Coker region. And Kiarostami and his team did genuinely go into Coker with the filmmaking team for these actors. As much as we're seeing a fictionalized accounting of it, it did naturally happen because the movie was made, which sort of makes this into some sort of like a docufiction almost. It's a fiction as to we're seeing an actor who's pretending to be someone else who is sort of fabricating a story, but the experiences around them in this present and very serious event is real. How is this not a documentary of at least some sort? But then we get to 1994's Through the Olive Trees, the third movie in the trilogy, which right from the start has an actor introducing himself as an actor who's playing the director of the movie, which again is not Abbas Kiarostami. And it's also not the guy who played the Kwasi Kiarostami in that Life and Nothing More. And this is taking nearly the opposite approach to subtlety that Life and Nothing More took. The fourth wall is broken immediately. It doesn't even exist. The first shot of the movie is saying, this is a movie that is being filmed. I am an actor. How are we supposed to process the rest of the movie? And this movie sort of, Through the Olive Trees sort of takes the stance of being a behind-the-scenes document of this director's upcoming fiction film. But a bit into the movie, you notice that the director from Life and Nothing More is also here, and he's playing an actor. And then you realize that this director is making his movie Life and Nothing More, but it's called And Life Goes On. And we sort of see this by he's directing his actors to play the scenes that were actually in that movie 3 years ago. There's also like, there are other sort of tie-ins that there's cameos from the kids from Where's My Friend's House? Not the ones they found in the movie, but the ones that Kiarostami was actually looking for. So just to catch people up, because that seems complicated, in Through the Olive Trees, we're seeing a director direct And Life Goes On, which is the story of a director going to find the kids from the other movie, Where Is My Friend's House? And presumably, at the viewing of each movie, we're supposed to think this movie was directed by Abbas Kiarostami. But then as you retract each layer, Kiarostami replaces himself with an actor playing him. It's just, it's a little too much to think about sometimes. I don't know. But through the production of the movie, we start to see more of the actor's feelings about acting, about the movie, and how it intersects with their own personal lives, mainly through the drama between an actor and an actress who play a newlywed couple in the movie who become married the day after the earthquake, explaining this to the director, that rather than staying to mourn all the family that they lost and obeying the traditions of marriage permissions, they decide to just get married immediately despite everything going on around them. And we see how this counters their actual reality as people, as the man wishes to get married to this woman, but her parents died in the earthquake and, as of living, objected. Her grandmother, who survived the earthquake, objected as well. And the actress wishes to abide by her wishes. So both of these characters sort of talk with the director and contemplate their place as actors in the movie and how it relates to them and is affecting them in the real world. But at this point, through all this complexity, it's hard to tell what Kiarostami is actually trying to say. Where is the reality in any of this filmmaking? In Life and Nothing More, we knew that the director was fake because it's not Kiarostami. So we know that they're sort of fabricated situations because it's not just, he's obviously not going up to random people and filming someone else talking to them, pretending he is someone who these actors do know from Where's My Friend's House. But through Kiarostami's movies, he always uses non-actors. So I sort of assumed that he was getting these non-actors to tell their real stories. This is how I looked at the movie. And I think that's what Kiarostami wanted us to believe at that point in time, as of having seen the second movie, but not the third one. But now, I think he was still almost doing that, although indirectly. We know that these stories are false, that they're not even accurate accounts of the actors' realities. But in Through the Olive Trees, we get to sort of understand some more in-depth linkages between film and the life around it, for some people at least. The film becomes almost a discussion of how art imitates life, or also how life imitates art, through this complex web of filmmaker creating an on-screen persona, which is eventually just another filmmaker creating an on-screen persona, we get lost onto who the real artist is. Who is pulling these strings, and what is the linear relationship between them? It is surprising to say that through all this complexity, Through the Olive Trees seems surprisingly grounded, as its main focus remains on the young actors who were casted in And Life Goes On, the film being shot, the ones I mentioned earlier, the newlyweds on screen, but not quite wed in real life. We see that these characters' lives nearly mirror the scenes that they're casted in, and it affects their perception of their own situation. I believe that what Kiarostami is actually aiming to show through all of this is that despite the falsity of nearly all films, that what the movies are depicting as reality is most likely nothing of the sort, an artist is capable of reflecting reality through stories. They might be stories that are made up, but people are going to naturally interpret these types of stories as somebody's reality. Maybe not literally, but in this case, they reflect something real. As these stories reflected the lives of the citizens of Coker, albeit fictionalized accounts that Abbas Kiarostami made up. But as much as the film reflects the realities, they also have the power to influence people. If the artists, they have a power to influence people's lives who see the reflection in it, if the artist carries a sense of life and shows a genuine respect for its subject's life and the medium that they're working in, in Abbas Kiarostami's case, film. And it is just really interesting to see how these films interact with each other from a sort of different level, because each movie is based off of the reality and the people who created the preceding movie. And I'm curious to see how much Abbas sort of knew or had plans for this series at the production of each one before it. I'd go to bet that Where Is My Friend's House would have most likely been standalone because it's a very straightforward narrative structure and that it was filmed and released before the earthquake. But it's hard to imagine that the latter two movies weren't made at around the same time, considering the approach taken, that it is pretty much like a behind-the-scenes depiction. And as you can sort of understand, I really loved these movies. I think that on their own, they're not as strong as they were together. Especially, Where Is My Friend's House sort of stands, after watching the whole thing, as sort of like a groundwork, a template for Abbas to work in. That the other movies are sort of taken from this fictionalized story before it. And then I think that Life and Nothing More is a great reflection on that, and that I find that Through the Olive Trees sort of almost works more as a supplementary to that movie, but it does the most to tie everything involved. But on its own, it is probably the weakest movie of the three. And I gotta say that these movies are in desperate need of a restoration, at least from the only sort of downloads that I could find. Particularly, the ending shot of Through the Olive Trees loses some of its effect, because it's this really long shot of characters walking into the distance, and they go really far away. It's a really wide shot. And then at the end, they just sort of end up being white spots in the distance that you see slowly pushing across the screen, like little pixels. But I did see an unofficial announcement for Criterion releasing this trilogy from Abbas's son, who's applauding the amount of work that they're putting into it. So I'm really excited to revisit the trilogy in this new, reinvigorated way. And I've been getting really into Abbas Kiarostami, particularly recently, because I'm on my way to watching 24 Frames, which was his posthumous movie. So after he died in 2016, I believe, and this movie was released in 2017. But I may be wrong. And I'm sort of trying to get to all of his movies before that. And I'm really excited to finish them all off, because as much as I've liked some more than others, they've all just held a certain power to them that is really respectable. And I really respect that in a filmmaker. Now I'm going to take a little break This is AV Terror with Horse. Johnny was a mobster, and throughout his whole career, he became very renowned in his field. He was critically revered as one of the best. By genre, he liked to be identified as New York drug trafficking and light torture. He'd worked long and hard to create a strong sense of character and professionalism through his work, and more importantly, his image. That was until his 30th birthday. As a fun little romp, the rest of the boys decided to throw Johnny a massive party filled with nearly everyone he knew from the city. Everyone seemed to be having a great time. Well, everyone except for Johnny. Being surrounded by his peers and his associates, Johnny began to reflect on his years in the industry, reflected on his greatest feats, what defined him as a mobster, and felt conclusive, a true body of work. But what would he be remembered for? He wasn't sure. Would it be police intimidation, waterboarding, small-time drug dealer recruitment? Maybe his work was more scattered than he once thought. A real mobster must have variety, that's certain. But even more important was the specialty. When he considered some of his idols, there was always something that stood out. Jermaine DeFranzo was an expert in lockpicking. Joey Raziolino was the only New Yorker who could shoot 6 police hats off before they'd even turn around. Blinko Macho knew Krav Maga, and even some of his contemporaries like Ralph O'Brien could pick up a dime bag and flip it across state lines in less than half an hour. Luckily, Johnny was able to take the week off as per his boss's permission. In this time, Johnny hit the tapes. He looked at all of his career, he looked at his highlight reels for the past decade of service, surveying for trends, what held his career together. He got Ricky, who took charge of filming most of the gang's joints, to prepare a specialty supercut of his finest hours together for him. It was usually considered unprofessional or dangerous to film your own crimes, but all the boys trusted Ricky. He was a pro, and the footage was excellent. He also used cop-proof encryption software. As much as Johnny appreciated the work that Ricky did, he didn't quite need the added soundtrack, consisting of Ricky's personal dubstep remixes of mob classics like Folsom Prison or practically any Frank Sinatra song. Johnny muted the video and began to study it. He hadn't remembered studying like this since his Beatings Without Bruises course back in mob school. He'd been practicing all week, but every time he attacked a random passerby in the street, they'd be covered in bruises, leaving unappealing marks and an increased legal liability, neither being good for Johnny's reputation. Johnny must have attacked a dozen folks in a single night, cramming for his early morning tests, so just so he could get it perfect. From his practicing, Johnny started to incorporate a fluid approach to his fighting. He was able to keep moving while adapting to his opponents and quickly offering swift blows. He liked elegance, and he liked to show it throughout all his operations. And this is what he noticed when he saw the tape. After muting the remix of Fly Me to the Moon, he put on an audio recording of Swan Lake and watched. Much to his surprise, it fit together quite well. He hadn't thought about it much, but his style lent a lot to dance. His mother had tried to put him in a variety of dance classes, believing Johnny was meant for more, but none of them really sticked. Johnny wasn't meant for that life, at least he didn't think so yet. Was this how Johnny was going to be remembered? Could this be something that could be branded? The Dancing Mob Man. He could imagine the billboards already. Not that there had been that sort of publicity in their field since the golden years, but as his agent had always told him, he had to dream big. In secret, Johnny took a series of dance classes on his time off. If he was going to commit to this act, he needed to do it well. In due time, Johnny obtained the skills that he thought were satisfactory to obtain suitable recognition. He didn't want to tell anyone that he was the dancing mobster. He wanted to be the dancing mobster and have everyone else tell him. It was around then when Johnny went back to work, and he was ready to show off. When the first opportunity came up in their casting meeting, Johnny sprang up and offered himself as the lead act, the muscle. It was a clear-cut job, a minor check-in with the Lower Manhattan drug dealer chapter, repossessing some of their goods, and it was bound to get physical. Johnny could feel the spring in his step already. When Johnny, Ralpho, and Marky blasted into the joint, they eluded confidence. It was natural and magnifying. Johnny took his place and let Ralpho and Marky deal with the business. He was there for a reason and he needed to focus. Without drawing attention, he popped in an earbud and put on something fitting to the situation's tempo. Johnny got lost in the music and nearly stopped paying attention to what was happening around him. He sprang back when one of the dealers pulled a handgun on Marky. This was his moment. With a spring in his step, Johnny sprang forward, placed only one foot on the ground, going right into a fast spin with the other leg impressively high, which hit the gun right out of the drug dealer's hand onto the floor. He went into a cartwheel, catching the dealer's head and his legs and throwing it right to the ground. They couldn't keep an eye on him. Not even Ricky could keep the camera steady on Johnny. Within 30 seconds, they were all down and Johnny had barely broken a sweat. He was proud with his performance. Ralpho and Marky were speechless. They had never seen a mob man swing and move like that. The precision, the beauty, the excellence. They looked at each other and they began to laugh. Johnny couldn't believe it. He should be a legend to them, but they weren't taking him seriously. To them, this was a joke. The mobster look was purely tough. It was serious and men were expected to act a certain way. Maybe Johnny had overlooked that trait of his peers when he had committed to this whole routine. Maybe he had overlooked this trait when he decided to become a mobster in the first place. Maybe his mother was right. When they got back to the crew house, Ricky showed everyone the tapes and they all laughed. Johnny felt terrible. His whole reputation was lost. He knew he couldn't stay with them anymore. The mob world just wasn't ready to mix with the world of high art. He had risked his career on this combination paying off, but it just wasn't time yet. Before Johnny left, he took Ricky's tape. He didn't want them to laugh at it anymore. Maybe he was going to put it online at some point. Maybe there was someone out there who would appreciate it. Maybe he would influence the next wave of young mobsters. He always knew he was ahead of his time. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to another episode of Owen's Variety Hour. I hope you had a good time. As always, ignorance of your culture is not considered cool. Have a good night. Here is Mort Garson with Ode to an African Violet.